Hey, welcome back. This is Elliot Litt, and we're here with Jose Alberg.
And Jose, I had a question for you because the first half of the show there, we were kind of talking about this a concept that you brought up of unity and having a little discussion about quote resolution and narrative. And in a way, it's like you were talking as if you were working against resolution and possibly unity in your work in a way,
Right.
and how that ultimately made your novel fail.
Yeah.
But it seems like you're also rather interested in this concept of unity. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think unity is just like a basic desire that we all human beings have. I think that we want to understand ourselves as making sense to the physical world and like the physical world makes sense back to us. But I think a lot of times because of politics of history, where unity might be denied because of a certain zero degree of, an exercise of power where maybe power is monopolized in one end and maybe taken from the other, or language even might have been monopolized as a form of power and then used to like oppress others, that we've sort of evolved from like these zero points in history, and we exist now as like children of time, and then we always strive for this unity, but there's something inherent in sort of our institutions in this country that doesn't allow us sort of unity. You know what I mean? So I think when I spoke of unity before in terms of this story, the characters are looking for unity, but their inability to sort of navigate the mechanisms of American society or navigate the institutions of them to achieve unity or to get unity as like a social reward is, I think it keeps them in like a static spin. You know what I mean? It keeps them chasing something that ends up being their own back. So in a sense, if you were to visualize it would be like a static spin. You know, there isn't like a straight progression forward or like an arrow of directionality, where unity is like an object that's somewhere off in space, but it's always just kind of stuck. And so when I talked about unity before and how I didn't want resolution because I don't think, life isn't that easy in this case. I couldn't have written a novel or like, first of all, I knew what the characters were trying to do or did or like were achieving, and then I wouldn't know how to like make that a story that fits like a narrative structure where you go from A to B to C to D, because I don't think that happens in real life. It's not that easy. I don't know what the hell a character is like 6 pages in because, I don't know, 6 years in on a person's life, I don't know what the hell they are. You know what I mean? I don't think it's even difficult for us to achieve that unity when we're children of time. You know, because it's difficult for us to even to achieve our unities because of like these zero degree moments in history where, it was defined what would be unity and what wouldn't, like what would be entitlement to unity and what wouldn't be. So a lot of times we always work and work and work to labor to achieve this unity that is like America or like being identified as American, but we don't get it. You know what I mean? We don't have that sense of entitlement. So that's kind of why it doesn't resolve, and that's kind of why I think it fails, because I think, well, shit, I should have let these characters succeed at least. Why did I have to force that on these people just because that's my pathos, you know what I mean? So that's kind of why I think that it fails.
But then they're surrounded by this kind of sensory unity. Everything's speaking to them, everything's kind of undulating and moving, everything is noticed, the grout. The tile, the towels, how they smell, where they're made. And that presents itself to them constantly. And yet at the same time, they're in dislocated.
Yeah, I think more happens to like ants in this story and dust than it does to people. But I mean, isn't that the case? You know what I mean? Like ants, I mean, I look at ants, I can like sit and stare at ants for hours. And they'll just like go and go and go. I'm like, do it, man. You know, God bless you. Because I mean, they don't have our same, pathology. They don't have our same institutions. You know what I mean? Like some European ant didn't come and kick the shit out of all of the native ants and then instill like some sort of weird system on them. You know, they're just ants. You know what I mean? They don't have the same sort of neuroses that we do.
Well, all right. Do you want to read the first
No,
section
I
of your
don't. I want to go
prose?
home. Yeah, okay, hold on.
All right. Okay, we can see what happens at dusk.
Yeah. All right, so this next, it picks up sort of where the last left off. These are, it's the story of what happens, this is what happens to the two characters, Carlos and Elizabeth, after, I mean, the character of Carlos doesn't speak at all until like page like 330 something. So like this is finally where he sort of awakens from his like, I've been trying to, I've been, I've been, you know, I'm an immigrant, I came to this country, I married this woman, I've had this family, and I've been so trying to, with my hands, like, mold a life, and it's failed. Yeah, so I kind of wrote at the same time when I was, like, going through my stuff, and he's like, and it's failed, and that's okay, you know what I mean? Because now I can come to terms with that failure and just, like, move on. So this is kind of this whole, what's happening here. Hola, pa. Hijo. A cigarette burns in the ashtray in front of Carlos, and it does this slowly. The dark fume filling a thin snake of space as if it is trying to make itself one with time so as to slow it all down to the meter of its rising and moving. It freezes as it expands in the space between the two, and Dolores and his father remain static across from each other. Carlos begins to remember a story in the sound of all this past, in the brief moment between hello and hello, and a look between them drawn out beyond the limitations of the entire house. Well above the glimmer of a street facing the ridges of Tijuana, peering over the edges of steep cliffs into the beds of cedro, and watching the traces of rainwater wash through its streets, down the angles of roofs into steady streams leading out into fields where the water swells. Tijuana continues to look with anticipation into the color green radiating even in the dark throughout the fields west of the dim lights of the city and the rushing traffic of the highway. Tijuana watches the rustling of treetops and the shaking of bushes as if something strangles them from their bases or is pulling up on their roots from well below the surface. Carlos's memory at this moment is strong enough to be the rain breaking apart all the dust and the dirt at this moment, which threatens the fields and is bringing Tijuana so much entertainment. At the hospital, Carlos stands like a jacket in the corner of Eutiquia's room as machines beep and hoses pump liquids. Latex balloons breathe like gorilla lungs in large glass incubators. The rooms are made of glass, the walls are glass, and the doors run into them. From one room you can see into the next room, and each room is sadder and then sadder. Hope becomes thinner with distance and outshouted by the bargaining between technology and time. The market yells fill the ICU, and Carlos sees the nurses continue with their business as merchants do, despite approaching tides and droughts in the shapes of clouds and horses. As transactions are carried out around them, and time continues to carve its notches with the sharp tip of an idle blade. The noise territorializes his body, which shakes in its corner as Alma watches him from the foot of Yutiko's bed, where she is curled up like a daughter. He will find strength in the crooked bark wrapped around Yutiko's body. He will remember all of his walking and her laying, and in the short humps of her legs under the hospital blanket, resting and waiting to begin walking again. Carlos will cry when he thinks of his father. He will cry when, in the imagination of his father, he is a mangled body so far from its home and alone after being so close to death and namelessness. The strength will not come from his tears. He will find pride in his father's eyes, and his father is already dead. Carlos will find the courage to remain standing in the room with Yutiquia. He will find pride also in standing for both of them, and his standing will become a substitute for walking because his walking is done. And he will at once feel it end in the sigh of a rubber lung and the beep of a squared plastic heart with red eyes, eyelashes like the tips of waves. It ends in the silhouette of blazing mountains Elizabeth sees from her half-open eyes as she sits in a car sailing through an empty road towards Nogales, miles away from this moment. Carlos will find in his father finally seeing him in America from a bed that has long since been left outside for garbage, rotted into mess, and been burned. Alma follows Carlos out of the hospital and walks close to the man. When he arrives, Elizabeth is already gone. He had been expecting this to happen. Despite this, his body has trouble adjusting to the emptiness of the house. Carlos imagines himself as a note to fill the house with a sound other than his feet and the clank of his keys on the table. From the lips of brass, he expands throughout the rooms and along the floor. He itches. He becomes lost in the chaos of echoes. And before long, the sustained note collapses. Years of notes fall through together at once. The song breaks before him, and he is then alone again. His body has become accustomed to slouching and falling feebly onto furniture, lying on couch cushions like a drape, sitting in chairs like a spiderweb. He melts into the next moment, and then the next, then the next. Alma sits beside him at the kitchen table, watching him, and finds new reasons to pray for the living. She sees that all his strength is regrouping itself somewhere in his hands, which he has set before him on the table, and holds something inside them. Poor man, she thinks. At once she is aware of his story. It is not difficult. Around the house, Elizabeth left a few things. She did this on purpose. At the moment she left, with Don Rogelio waiting outside out of some sense of respect, Elizabeth hurried, even though she had been packed for days. She scrambled through last cabinet drawers where she kept nothing but old sweaters and torn shirts and socks she swore she would still someday rely on. She tossed it all into the bed. From the bed, she dragged whatever her hand grabbed and let it rain in the hallway, on the table by the floor, on the living room floor. She flung an old mitten that smelled of snow into the kitchen on her way out. This is all so hurried, she focused herself to think, even though it had begun way before Cidro. This will be the last thing I say to him, she decided, as she closed the door thinking of Carlos, and what better way to tell him goodbye and thank you, that the past still mattered, and that she would love it in her own way and remember it somehow, but only when alone. Now Carlos sits with Alma. The smell of moisture is still locked in the yellow cotton of the mitten in his hand, and it has been brought out of the shelter of his hands and up against his lips. Old snow and water inside the cotton is the only thing that keeps him from crying. It would seem stupid to cry to such an already abused thing, he thinks. Cidro has suddenly become cold, and it seems fitting that there is a glove like Elizabeth's in the house and that he found it in such a place like the kitchen. It now rests there on the table next to an ashtray in his hands. The smell of old snow begins to hurt his memories, his wife and his son, always so distant, so distracted. He feels as though he should be happy in a way. He has always secretly blamed her for Dolores, her lack of love and affection, her refusal of him. Now he blames her openly. Carlos stands in the snow of some memory the glove calls for, staring at his son. He now finds the courage to say the things he has always waited for Elizabeth to say first. He puts his hand on the mitten and pushes it off the table as it snows in his mind. Elizabeth's hand shivers in it. He waits to see her ask for it back. She puts her hand in her pocket instead. Carlos exhales and turns to Dolores, who has begun walking towards him in difficult steps through the thick snow between them. Do you want to talk about this section, or do you want to?
Yeah. There's one thing that the one character that maybe didn't quite get because we don't have a larger section of this novel, but Eutychia, can you talk about who she is?
Yeah. And this goes back again to what I was trying to do with the book as a whole, that there are real people and quote unquote fictional people. Eutychia was a woman. Or is a woman that works for my dad in Tijuana. She is from Guatemala. And her goal was to sort of, you know, cross the border into the U.S. and be reunited with her son and her sister who live in New York, New Jersey. And then the night when she finally sort of, I guess, accumulated enough money and sort of, you know, it was her turn to go. One way that people cross the border is like they sort of just pack into vans. You know, and they cross like real, you know, far east from San Diego proper, where it's, you know, it's a little bit easier to sort of go by undetected or sort of unpoliced, and then sort of drive these like dangerous sort of old, you know, highways like east of San Diego in the desert, usually with their lights off, so Border Patrol cars don't see them, and so, you know, she was in one of these vans, and it did tip over and it did sort of crash. And she did sort of become seriously injured. And this is her, you know. But I think just, you know, I'm always observing sort of things around me. Because I think, and this goes back to what Stephanie said about these little moments. I mean, these little moments go by and like we let them go by and they're gone. But I think there's a lot of stuff in them, you know, that we don't really realize. Even if it's just like seeing something really small for you personally, it, you know, maybe it jars like this incredible memory. That's something, you know what I mean? Why is that not nothing? You know, it's not like this huge event that's going to make the news, but it's like something, you know, and it's real and it happened.
And it's kind of like, I mean, for example, like the mitten.
Yeah, exactly, like exactly. And then, like, so, I mean, that's kind of like my process, you know, that I walk around a lot. I don't have, you know, like cable. I just walk. And I just look at these moments, or like if I'm daydreaming, I daydream a lot, and I look for these moments, you know. And I think, and so, you know, and for this novel, I used a lot of real people that were real to me. And so, I mean, I was hanging out with my dad once, and he was just like talking, and I already knew who this woman was because he had told her about me. I mean, he had told her to about her to me. Sorry, you know, the story always sort of caught my mind because she's. That's like some serious determination, you know what I mean? And this goes back to, I mean, we'll get into it later, but how like the son, there's like huge disconnect between the son and the father in this case. And it's you know, when you're a child and you're an immigrant, or like even if you're born to immigrant parents, I don't think you fully appreciate, you know, what your parents went through, because you don't have to go through it. And that's fine, because you have your own stuff to go through. But there is something in there that becomes, again, like pathological, and there's a lot of pathos in this. But like for me personally, it's like, I mean, you still have to navigate that in your head, you know? You still have to navigate that in your imagination, what your parents went through, because that becomes what you define yourself as now. That becomes like the pride that you take in everything that you do now, like your job or like sort of your character, you know? People don't understand this when, you know, when we discuss immigration in the U.S., but they don't understand that we all have that in our heads as immigrants. You know, we all have that in our actions. You know, we all have that in our labor, in our sort of pride in ourselves, in our character, and the things that we're willing to do. You know, because we have a lot of shit to deal with. You know, and I don't think people understand it. And so, this character Yudiko, she was a real woman. You know, she had this accident, and she was in San Diego in the ICU, and she made it out. You know what I mean? And she still works with my dad now. Right, and that's her plan, is still to kind of be reunited with her son. And I think anytime I hear stories about, you know, her from my dad, it's always, you know, it's like half inspiring, half sort of half like, I don't know, like scolding, you know what I mean? Because you kind of scold yourself. It's like, you know, I'm not doing enough, you know what I mean? Yeah. I get upset because I gotta work late,
right?
So I mean, yeah, that's who she is.
Well, are there any questions from the audience? I'd like to invite anybody that has any questions right now, or we can move on. I think Amar might.
I got a question about your boots, Amar.
You like them, my boots? Well, anyways, I'm intrigued by your notion of a cipher, especially New Cedro as a cipher, like economically and in terms of labor and people. And so it made me wonder what a character like Alma, who's also a real person, how she's a cipher for you as a writer. Like what you let through your characters and what you don't allow to go through.
I would say that her as a cipher for me, you know, I mean, my interactions with her were very sort of, I didn't know her that well. I knew her friend more, you know. But her story is one that I share value-wise as like a resident of this place, you know what I mean? And that I have like a certain literacy and like the events, you know what I mean? That not everyone would, picking up a newspaper and reading like a smart little column about a girl who died jaywalking. So as a cipher, I think I find value in her on more than one level. You know, but it's because of like those more than one levels that I know that I can't allow all those levels to go through. You know what I mean? And that was, it was kind of a difficult thing to use her, because I had to force myself to not let all of her through, and then to the book. You know, because I think there is a part of her, because I am literate and like I know that she has a family. Like I've met her mom. I know. You know what I mean? I know like what they must be going through. I know. What she was before, what she was after, what she symbolizes, to people who want to say like, yeah, see, that's why it's like self-fulfilling prophecy. They all do it to themselves. But also what she symbolizes to people is like, man, she was like sober. It was like her 18th birthday, you know? And so I've had to navigate like that literacy, you know, and like kind of pick and choose what values are most useful for me. You know, what values will make the strongest sort of symbol out of her. Yeah, because that's what she becomes. She becomes like a symbol, you know. And I mean, that's part of like the pathos for me personally, because I don't want her to be a symbol, but I know that that's what I'm doing. And I know that as a strength for someone picking up something that they don't know anything about, they're not going to get that full literacy that I have. So then I have to create a literacy for them.
So then have you shown your work to her family?
I've shown it to the her friend, the guy that I know, and he knows that I'm doing this, you know, and we've had talks about it. But no, I haven't shown it to her family, And I don't think I will. You know, like a year and a half ago, maybe it was like a big deal for me. I was like, fuck, I should do it. I should really do it. I was like, why? You know what I mean? What do you think's gonna happen, Jose? What, they're gonna say, oh, good. I don't want a certificate of appreciation, and I don't want their validation. I don't want any of that. You know what I mean? I've kind of gone beyond that, and I want her to be real, the way, you know, here. You know, she's not gonna be real again, I know, but I want her to be real here because there are more almas out there. Thanks. Good question.
Are there any other questions right now? Otherwise, Jose, do you want to read another section?
Yeah.
Okay.
So now we're back, and this is actually occurring in Carlos's head. So I know it sounds like he's talking, but he's not really talking. So hold off on that. The day I met your mother, I was sitting in a park in that afternoon. There had been a lot of wind that day, more than usual. And it had been a strange wind, too, now that I remember. Loud and cold in the shade, but loud most of all. Almost in a scary way. I had been sitting on a bench in this park, staring at a poor, crooked tree. It was completely crooked, leaning towards the ground. In El Salvador, as a child, I would always like to visit my grandfather's house because of all the trees and plants he had. It was not a large house, but he always felt the need to have trees around him. He used to talk to them, and I remember that he would do this always, no matter who else was around. He told me once that talking to trees was the only thing he had to keep him from going crazy. At the time, I was confused by this because I thought men who talked to trees were crazy. But sitting in this park much later, I finally realized what he meant. I had arrived alone to Ciudad Juarez. I crossed the border of El Salvador with a friend who stayed in Guatemala. In Guatemala, I met a girl about my age, maybe a little older. She died at the Mexican border from some sickness I never quite understood. Mexico is a huge country. It is a lot of land. I saw it all by myself. Or at least I should say that what I saw made all of what I imagined its borders to be. Its mountains, deserts, and the cities, all the cities. I could have spent a whole lifetime seeing Mexico. But you know, I left El Salvador with the dream of seeing America. If Mexico was huge, I could only imagine what America was like. Hijo, I'll tell you honestly, you can never expect life to happen. That is not what living is, to know what will happen and how. I was wrong to think then I would be happy. I was wrong to think I had an understanding of what I wanted in life. I remember sitting on a bench, the most uncomfortable bench in Mexico, feeling tired. There was a small tree, which must have either been partially uprooted or just grown from the earth that way, doomed from the beginning. You couldn't really tell for sure. The dirt around its base of the trunk was smooth and unbroken, giving nothing away. Someone had nailed a triangular mess of 2x2s and plastic pipes together with old red electrical wire to its trunk in order to hold it up. I must have even walked past it earlier, but I didn't see it until I had already been sitting for some time. You see, there was not much to do in Ciudad Juarez for me, especially because apart from that day, it had been extraordinarily hot. I was looking to cross the border only, not make a life for myself there. I was tired, and this bench offered me no welcome position to nap in. I remembered also that there was a sort of rally going on. There were young women speaking about their experiences, but I was confused as to what exactly they were saying. I was tired, Dolo. I just wanted to sleep, but I couldn't with the noise, and what's more, I felt like I was being watched. I finally decided to lay on the ground and sleep. I had only hesitated because I did not want people to think I was a bum or a drunk like the rest of the men sleeping on the grass in the late afternoon in the parks of most of the cities I had seen. I was a worker, and I had plans even if they were not real then. No, is that how it happened? Ciudad Juarez is a city of streets, and the fronts of buildings and houses come up right to the edges of them. The streets are made important this way, and how everything wants to be a part of what's happening on them. To hear the stories and smell the food sold on them, feel the exhaust of large red buses on their faces to prove they are in Juarez, that they feed off the blood that flows through the streets like veins and connect the city with the taste of tar. You awoke when the streets spoke. You relaxed to the ticking of iron stoves cooling off under the heavy gaze of Lavender's evening skies, feeling the stretching of your skin the way streets spread themselves out as if relaxing without the busy presence of cars and their traffic tensing them. You slept when it was dark, but not until the last drunk made it to his corner or found the softest patch of sidewalk. Not until the last argument, the last declaration of love. Not until the last of the day's gossip became a wisp of air or an echo in your dreams. And even then you slept according to the street outside your window. It had a rhythm. It breathed. And no matter where you hid yourself, there was a window, and outside this window you found the street staring back at you, and it whispered to you a song of the city, a a relentless hum, a note held to its bone. I walked around a lot, mostly before dark and early in the evenings. Will I say this now? But no. I walked around a lot. The streets and their winding, their incessant directions, and then the way light played through the corridors created by the eager faces of buildings lined on either side, invasive. Corridors leading directly out into fields of nothing, waiting like hungry mouths to devour us. Young men like me, old men, women, children, crazy people who spoke to the wind, living in some other world that the hands of Border Patrol agents inevitably crumpled between their gloves, always. Always the river to the north, the mountains to the south looking bruised in the evenings when the light was low. And the only place for the moon was the sand and its own glimmering reflection in the river, lapping up against the long hip of the city where we all waited together before the cross. A lot of times I also sat alone. I ate alone. I drank coffee alone and slowly, letting the day crawl over the tabletop and across my hands laid on it motionless like napping dogs. I would feel the sun heat them. It was cold where my calluses touched the surface and the wind blew through the thick cracks of skin caused by the dry desert atmosphere of Juarez. It was the worst place for a city when one thinks of great cities. But what a city. It sat there on its patch of dirt at the edge of one of the most dangerous rivers, as if it was designed by forever to be on its own, a place made by time to sit over and watch age. And forever must have intended the people of Juarez to go on and age with it, locked in by mountains, a desert, and a river. What a city. What a people that passed through it and changed it all with something as easy as walking. You must understand that even at that time, Ciudad Juarez was huge. There were large buildings and parks, monuments, boulevards, but there were also smaller parts to the city that if you were to see it from above, gave the city texture and density. Remember what you have come back for. Yes. And then there is Elizabeth, or was, I suppose, your mother. I never saw her the same way once on this side. Not the way I saw her then, looking up from the grass, my legs tired from walking, pain at the sides of my knees wrapping around my ankles. I felt like the small tree lying on the grass under its sickly shade. I wished for its braces on my legs. I imagined the tree as another man, tired of walking, and upon reaching the edge of the world, as I felt myself to be, becoming frozen in the body of a tree. But then there she was, Elizabeth looking down at me. I forgot so much finality. This is a way of saying more, that I saw my future as I dreamed it in her face at that instant. No, but it felt this way. Maybe looking back, it was only a twitch, and it carried on in my mind long after. No, that's not what it was then. I was on my knees when I saw her. We were across from each other with a trash can between us. I was tired. It happened this way. She must have seen in me what I felt. I thought then that I saw the same in her eyes. They were big eyes. I suppose they still are big eyes. We smiled before we said anything. I laughed even when I couldn't speak. I wanted to tell her that it was because I was happy. I was happy. For 6 days, I was happy. I thought she was happy too. Maybe she really was. This is dark in my mind, Dolores. It has hurt for a long time now. It's hurt slowly and each day more. The hurt is like dripping mud that through the years has coated my spine and slowed me, hunched me. It's made me weak in a lot of ways. That small tree hung still to its trauma and lived inside its crooked shell. And what would I be eventually? A root, I guess, a twig or a small puddle, a patch of dirt in the park. I suppose I am something small but existing always in some form or another, even if not always in the eyes of anxious young men in the parks of Ciudad Juarez. I ran into that city blinded by the momentum of my walking and tripped in the gaps of people's stories along the way. Scraping pieces of me on the ground wherever I fell, I hope now at least that I left some sort of smear, that I was a blur in other blinds running. Elizabeth's. When the blind stop running, they stand bleeding at the edge of what they will not go beyond out of fear, fatigue, or fulfillment. And it is only then that they begin to live on with their wounds, cringing from the rain on their cuts. When people reach Ciudad Juarez, like me, they walk through the city, passing as people the same way I first passed this small tree. This man, his crooked bark, the man frozen in that small tree held up there with his 2x2 crutches and laughing at us. Smiling at us because he knew what time would inevitably bring, what time always brings, what forever does at the border of a dream made crazy by the hissing of a river's current and the endless purple shadow of desert and mountain. But I know that I was on my knees already when I saw her. There is more. More. Elizabeth, where are you now? How have you returned to the place of your death, Nogales? I am not angry with you. What I've given you, you can have forever, and I will keep all that you have left with me, Dolores, half-broken child, half-sleeping man. Maybe he is just tired of all the walking we have both done. What else is he supposed to be but confused? Together, you and I, we could really map our little world, but I'm sure we wouldn't find one common thing. Elizabeth, we could not find our home. There was something you left behind, and I understand that. My promises were real to you, but they have never really been what you needed. I admit now that I never knew what you wanted, and in this way you were never really real to me after Ciudad Juarez. I will never accept that you weren't real then, that your eyes weren't black and endless in my face. I will never accept that you weren't somebody my promises made giggle when I shouted them as we walked through the noise of a city so thick it still rings. Take what I gave you and keep it if that's what you needed. We all need. We each have a story, and you have the right to yours. A story which on certain nights I believe I got close to making out between breaths and in the marks of your fingers spelling scrawled letters of, at least, a moment of your reality on my skin. Then there is what begins to be ours. You have the story of us somewhere with you. I don't need it now. It has already left me standing in a city whose name for now I will try to forget. And it has moved on behind you. It will someday, when you become careless or tired, walk into your back. I will be remembering another city then, and repeating its name. It will be as memorable as a small crushed body of a mosquito in my hand, or the map of streets I carry in my incessant walking. I've always wanted to tell you this, Dolores. It ties you to what came before, that which I never talked to you about. But you should know this. You should know that a poem waits for you like this, like a paper cup on the lip of a trash can and a conversation, stale coffee sitting in the sun between warm hands, a park and a crooked tree, a scary wind, a coolness in the shade, and awaits, I fear, like my father, whom I've never told you about. I left him, Dolores, to find myself in work as he slowly died. And as he died, he did so as a house does without anyone inside it. I carried his memory inside me like furniture, forever alive. But he is lying in a bed in this poem, and in his mind there is a dream of a young man with his head, and he is walking alone on uneven streets. The young man is me, but the head is his, and it has just finished raining everywhere before him. Perhaps that is why the wind blows this way, and it is not normal for rain where this poem waits uncomfortably on a bench. If I could speak to him, my father, I would warn him that the streets are long, and I would warn you also, sitting alone with these verses. I would warn the both of you as an old woman does in Ciudad Juarez, with the thickness of her ankles showing proudly, or perhaps just always. Or I would warn the both of you as an old man does, or maybe as a person already tired of even being old. And I would warn my father as this person warns the world of rain and of distance and of the clumsiness and fragility of cities. I would warn him the way this person shows the world a thick yellow toenail, which the confused young, you, and maybe even me, living as dreams of their fathers, think of as bread, and walk around weighing the faces of the tired and bread, and even at times become lost. I am careless and young with you while you visit this poem in your memory. I have walked cities looking for a man with my limp, for a man with my back and my elbow. I have looked for my father's head, and I carry with me a blunt stone, which I grip constantly. Dolores, what is it you're waiting for? Father.
Man, all this has really been making me think a lot about the border and what you've spoken about people moving and what drives them to move and to migrate and then to settle here if possible, and then how the experiences of their children will differ.
Yeah.
And yet how their children are called upon to bring that experience to life in their own way, and just how much of a fact the border remains.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to permeate everything that these people, the characters in your pieces, experience in a way.
Yeah.
Between each other, even borders are erected and.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, I mean, when you live in a country that's, you know, whose history is defined by a certain, a certain, like, 0 degree, you know, like, a certain meeting between two people, like, a Spanish dude and, like, an Aztec guy, you know what I mean? And what occurred afterwards, I mean, all our institutions are based on that history, you know, And then all of its children, you know, all of the people of this time are defined also by that history. And so this issue of borders, it's, you know, we can talk about, you know, the American border like day and night, but I don't think we ever talk about what it does to us, you know, psychologically, you know. When we don't live according to, you know, this problem-solving philosophy, I think we live according to the philosophy of our time period, and we live according to borders. We live according to sort of power structures, you know. We live according to dichotomies. And I think that's like a major problem. And that's like the major, you know, that's what oppression is, I guess, you know, because you're oppressed on no matter what side you stand on it, which is why even there's like this all, you know, this horizontal border building, even between these characters, you know, there's horizontal violence. There's horizontal animosity, you know, because that's our history. That's what we've learned to be. All right. But then when, you know, when you embody like a very obvious side of the border, it becomes even more complex because you don't think you should be having those like sort of feelings, but you do. Yeah. So, I don't know.
But I think in Los Angeles, especially for people who don't often leave the city,
yeah,
there's a tendency, even not that far north, to forget what all that
means. And I don't even think it's forgetting. I don't think they ever knew in the first place, you know, which is even worse. It's like not even forgetting. It's like just, yeah, I mean, how can you explain that to them when that's all they've known, you know? So, yeah, yeah.
I don't know, are there any questions in the audience coming up? Yeah?
Hi, my name is Wendy, and I just have a pretty quick question. Just if you can describe your work in or summarize it in three words, what would it be?
I hate you.
Are those the three words?
What? Oh, man, I don't know. Jesus Christ.
I know it's like college question.
I don't know. I'd have to think of it.
I don't know. That's three.
Is that, I don't know. Is that good? Should I go with that? Is that kind of emo? Sorry. No, I mean, yeah, it's like... I don't know. What would you like to hear?
I don't know. It depends on you. Like.
Oh, man. In three words? Why three words? Can we do five, maybe? Like seven?
No. Yeah, sure. Five.
I think my work for me personally is, you know, problem solving. Yeah. My work for me personally is, like, it's, you know, possibility of language, I guess. Possibility of myself. I don't know. It's really weird because I take it really personal, you know. And I don't think, you know, I just take it way too personal, I think. That's like, what, seven? Is that cool? Is that what kind of what you wanted to hear? I mean, I don't know. That's a really tough one. I don't know. That one's really tough. It's just because I feel like my work has changed like so much. Like, I don't... But it always remains as like me sort of trying to problem solve for myself. I'm trying to make myself understand myself, you know? Because if I don't understand myself, then what's the point? Burp. You know what I mean? What's the point if I don't understand myself, you know? So, yeah, I think it's that.
Thanks,
Wendy. Sorry about the burp.
I'd like to ask you one question about kind of this story that at least, especially this section that you just read is very much like, you know, a father trying to communicate to a son. And I think also through the rest of your book, it's the son Dolores is like, really, I believe in other sections that I've read in the past, that the son Dolores is trying to like figure out his father's story as well.
Yeah.
Other people's stories.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, I mean, even in Carlos's story that we got, you know, he talks of his father that he left and would never talk to. And what I find interesting is that in this work, you know, you're talking about passing down stories, and you know, and it also rings almost like as like a road novel or something like that. And there's like walking,
thanks,
there's lots of traveling. If that makes sense,
it's a road novel.
It's
called Bakersfield to Barstow.
Well, what's interesting is
Americana.
You take like some pretty you know, rooted American, like, novelistic themes.
Yeah.
This kind of father-son thing, this kind of, you know, this kind of movement and travel
type of theme,
but you've turned it into something a little bit different. Right.
Right. So
talk to me about that.
Well, let's talk about the storytelling first. I don't think we're a culture of storytelling anymore.
Okay.
You know, how could we be? You know what I mean? Like, when you think of how stories are passed down within, like, a cultural context, it's like you hear them from, like, a grandmother or, like, a mother. But you would expect that this mother or grandmother are at least, like, 20 years older than you. You know what I mean? When your mother is, like, I don't know, like, 12 years older than you, or, like, 13, 14, 16 years older than you, what are you going to talk about? You're going to talk about contemporary things. You're not passing down stories, I don't think. You know what I mean? And I think when we don't do that. We live like in a society of constant presence. You know what I mean? Where what is now is the style of now, and that's, we're all sort of unified by that constant state. We don't live in a state where, like, we have generations and they're clearly demarcated and we pass down these great stories, right? We ignore our histories, I think. You know, and I think that hurts. And it hurts especially when for immigrant families when we come, because we buy into this American society. And then I think a lot of immigrant families begin to buy into that sort of leaving their stories behind and living in a state of being constantly American. Because that's what American is, it's being constant, it's being present. You know, it's not about being past, future, possibility. It's about being constant.
Yeah.
It's about
you can talk about that, you know, I mean, the history of immigration, I think it's Wilson that talked about how, like, when you come to America, you should shed your identity and become American,
right?
And so it's the idea that a lot of immigrant families maybe.
Yeah, and you start seeing, like, immigrant families, like immigrant children, like little Latino families, you know, like the kid is named Jeff. Why is he named Jeff? You know, you have a history of names. You know what I mean? You have a process of naming.
Yeah.
Why are you named Jeff? You know what I mean? And why is your mother, like, 18? It's like, come on. Like, we need, I think it's, you know, that sounds very judgmental, but I think that it really hurts me, and I think that we hold our cultures back when we lose our foundations, because we get attacked at from various sides, and we become very vulnerable. And, you know, and then we begin to break apart and dissipate, which is what I think a lot of people want, and I don't want that, you know? So I think that when I say these things, they sound judgmental, but I only say them because I think that they're true and they need to be said. And I think I'm very happy to live within a culture that's my own culture, that we have sort of mechanisms of indicting ourselves. You know what I'm saying? Like, come on, man, let's raise our cultural bar, you know? Let's not let this happen to us, right? We can't lose our stories. We can't lose our names. We can't lose our histories. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that we can't be American. And this kind of ties into what I'm saying about, there are a lot of sort of, you know, like, American tropes in here. Then why shouldn't there be? I live in America.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's like,
absolutely.
So it's like, I mean, that creates a lot of problems for me, because, you know, all of a sudden I wrote a book about the border, but it's like, you know, I use very sort of American themes, and it's like there's a lot of sort of literary aspects to it. They may not be sort of conventional in the sense of being like a border book. You know, I don't know. And this goes back to the publishing thing. I can't go to, like, a Chicano press and say, hey, here. They'll be like, what the hell is that? You know what I mean? Chicano presses are usually pretty conservative. You know, it's like, this is what a Chicano book is.
Right.
Right? But then I can't go to a literary press and say, hey, check it out. It's like, oh, you wrote about the border. Yeah, that was like 1996. We're not doing that anymore. It's like, fuck you. The border's still there. What the hell? You know what I mean? Yes. I mean, you know, I did it because, like, I think it should have been done, you know?
Yeah.
And I both want to be American but still have my past. And why the hell shouldn't that be allowed? And so when I wrote this book, I wanted the same thing. I wanted to show how horrible it is, you know, just internally to have to deal with this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, how does, like, the son make his father real? Because the son can't make the father real unless he makes himself real. But there's no mechanism for, like, you know, immigrant, you know, teenagers to make themselves real without compromising who they are, without selling out who they are, right? At least a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and so then, like, how do they do it? Well, they don't. They can't. There's no mechanism. You know? I think now that there's a lot of sort of, I think we live in a really cool time period, I gotta say. You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of things happening right now in terms of all of a sudden these objects becoming accessible to like a wide range of people, stuff like iPods, stuff like, you know, like the internet, MySpace and all this stuff. Like stuff. Like, I mean, I use this all the time when I teach. It's like, but stuff like reggaeton is like, do you guys understand what this means? This is like, you know, dialectical materialism. This is like something coming together and being something else now. It's a synthesis. It's a communication between histories. You know, they're taking like these old cumbia beats and they're rapping to them. Do you understand what this means now? Yeah. Do you understand? You know, like, I don't think they get it. But it's but it's no, and it's accessible to everyone. You can turn on your radio and hear it. And I don't think they understand that if we don't all embrace it culturally, it'll be co-opted. You know what I mean? If we don't use like these opportunities that we have to have access to technology and access to the machines that make, you know, because you need to have access to technology to make this music. Yeah. You need access to quote unquote machines. You know what I mean? Yeah. You have to have access to these things. And if we don't take advantage of this access, it will become something else. You know what I mean? If we don't use this access to sort of finally make our statement that like we are this culture. You know what I mean? Yeah. We are American because we have access to these American machines. And we are filling them with ourselves and our histories and our past. And we're not asking anyone else to give up their stuff. We're just saying this is what we're making. Enjoy it. You know what I mean? We're not saying enjoy it, but you can't listen, you know, to Neil Young. You know, it's like no one's saying that. You know what I'm saying? And so I try to tell my students all the time, because my students are predominantly Latinas. So I'm saying we need to take advantage of this access now, because this is what culture is. This is what society is. It's access to these machines. It's access to these objects that history makes, because that's how we own history. We own the value of these objects that history makes, and we own this history. That's why this time period is really sort of. I'm really excited. I mean, I know it doesn't show, but I am really excited, you know, and so, I mean, obviously this character is not feeling that same vibe, you know, they're on the other end, right? But that's kind of the point that I was trying to make. It's like, that's why it feels like so static. You
know? Well, when Carlos leaves, though, I sense there's more than just economics that's driving him.
Oh, when his wife leaves, you mean?
No, Carlos leaves is when he talks about leaving his own father.
Oh, Yeah, I mean, I don't really get into that whole story of like, you know, how, because that's even like, that would be like another like 300 plus pages, but it's like.
But even so much like what drives him, I mean,
or what drives
you definitely
anybody.
Get into it when he's stopped in Ciudad Juarez. Yeah. And he can imagine like living in Mexico, and he can imagine all right. his borders, but there's something that drives him like to.
Right. And that's the part that I can't answer, because I was never, sure. I never had to make that choice. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what my parents saw. I mean, I've tried to like get it out of my dad, and like, you know, he tells me and stuff, but it's very difficult to make that real. It's real for him, but it's hard for me to make it real for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, who knows, you know, but I mean, it's something, or else no one would be coming here, right? You know what I mean? And I mean, there's been a lot of migrations. There's been the migrations within the U.S. itself. You know, there's like the northern migrations, like the post-slavery northern migrations, mm-hmm. the western migrations, you know, I mean, there's, people migrate, man. And that's what happens. That's how we know the world, man. We migrate.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how I know you. I migrated myself.
So. Right, from Minneapolis.
Does anybody out on the audience have any questions for Jose?
I think Matias has a question. It's going to be serious.
Hi. My question is really simple, actually.
Okay.
It's... what's your relation to and influence, if any, to Chicano studies? Because there are themes in the book that certainly play a big role in the discipline known as Chicano studies.
Right. Yeah. You know, my history with Chicano studies was, you know, I was at UCSD. It was like, you know, maybe like 7 Latinos, like a lot of white people, Asians. When I fell into sort of the Taco Shop Poet Calaca Press crowd, it did give me something to identify with, you know what I mean? I was like, well, here are like other like people who were writing, you know what I mean? And I started working with Salta, and we started doing a lot of stuff that we quote unquote called Chicano art and stuff like this. For me, it's always been kind of a political term. You know, it is a sort of political identifier. It's saying, you know, that we are taking this sort of, this negative term and making it a positive. In the most like basic sense, I mean, there's more complex, but that's kind of how I became attracted to it. And I think that I did get really sort of into Chicano studies only to know that history of politics, especially in Southern California. And I'm still very sort of aware of it now, and I still sort of, I use that term as a political term still, you know, when I have to. And I did incorporate it here because out of that sense of respect for that sort of political historical point where Chicano did become this like identifier of a group of sort of students and a group of young people and a group of artists and a group of, you know, men and women who work and men and women who labor, like a group of immigrants who were working to produce an identity for themselves, and they came up to a limit, you know, but their possibilities reached beyond that limit, and so they had to like do something, some form of political action to break that limit apart, and so I respect that very much, you know, and I try to sort of always, you know, live up to that same philosophy, because I think it's, you know, I think the term Chicano can mean a lot of things now, especially, you know. I don't think it's Chicano studies in the same sense where there are like, you know, these Chicanos who feel themselves to be like these gatekeepers to what it means to be Chicano, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I'm more Chicano than you, man. You know, it's like, well, I don't care, dude. You know what I mean? What's that? That's so stupid. So I don't think it's in that sense, but I think it is more in the sense of this possibility, you know? Yeah. Because that's my experience here. I mean, it's even hard sometimes for me to consider myself. I was like, what, like a month old when I came here, you know what I mean? My experiences have been American experiences. But Americans' experience of me has been as a Latino. And the only thing I have in terms of literacy of navigating that politically are Chicano studies. And so then I use that, yeah.
Any further questions? Or?
Uh-oh. Oh, Omar.
That's okay.
Uh-oh, his boots are made for walking. That's just what they'll do.
All right, one of these days. The one thing that I... You say your text is really static, but then it's all about remembering and keeping things to, you know, keeping them in your memory,
yeah,
and giving that to other people, right? But then for me, like one of the most static moments, which you also referred to in like our history now, is, you know, waiting for a plane to hit a tower.
Yeah,
right?
That's like the ultimate irony.
It's like permanently ingrained in our memories.
Right.
So I was wondering how that static and the static that you feel of your text, like how they relate, or are they completely different?
I think they're different in that one is sort of enforced on people just by the way things are set up institutionally. And the other is just like a static that we all walk into like a bunch of sheep. You know what I mean? It's like we all walk into that static of waiting for something to happen because we've been told, and this goes into some other stuff, but I mean, one is walked into, one is enforced, I would have to say. I don't think people choose to be static in terms of like the characters here. I don't think they would want to be. And I think that's the point why that makes them static, is like their desire to move forward in a directionality, but being redirected back around into like this circular motion, you know? And that becomes static, but that's not what they want, you know? I think the other one is like a kind of wanting static. You know, we all want something to happen, but I don't think deep down we all do. You know what I mean? I think sometimes you can sit at home alone and think, what if I just died? That would be, I mean, all this shit would just go away. I would just die. I would not, you know what I mean? None of it would, I would just die and it would be gone. I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to do this. I would just die. But we don't want to die. And I think you find that out fairly quickly if you ever get close. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I think one is they're slightly different, but I mean, you know, I see how you're saying how they might be related, yeah. But I think they are different. Good question, though.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, do you want to read the last section, and then we'll call it?
That'll. I don't even know if I want to. Yeah, let's do it, whatever. Yeah, it's like a half a page. The rain has been holding itself at the edge of Cedro, at its beach where Tijuana scoops a small parcel of sand in its palm and watches it darken with the moisture of the air on its side of the thin fence lined with poles, like bones beginning to sweat drops of sky from the rust blistering along the length of them, into the water where long green strands of weed wave in the tide like hair. It may even seem that the sky waits angry and black the way time waits over cities to see them age and change. Cities die eventually, with time remaining always frustrated that there is always someone to remember a moment and live on with it. Cities do not die completely. They carry a legacy inside their concrete blossoms the way so much pollen waits for its turn in the browning petal of a flower, which is still so small in the mind of a boy sweeping the entrance to a church, who is himself a part of someone's memory. Dolores waits at the face of this black hour, which has come to Cedro in the shape of a cloud and has brought the powers of time and small droplets of rain it holds at the border of land anxiously. Dolores, old, a woman rubbing her hands and waiting for an end, so much story, smiles finally at the long beard of sky tickling the skin on her face as she sits in front of her trailer on the beach. A breathing field behind her already beats to the pulse of small streams of pre-rain. Dolores smiles at last, and in between her rubbing fingers there is moisture. It has flooded her thoughts now as Carlos looks up into the face of his son and sees so much of Elizabeth. His breath falls from his mouth the way the sky falls, rustling through the long whiskers of its mustache and then beard, the tips of its beard floating in the wash of the Pacific at Dolores' feet. It falls from his mouth this way onto the table where it kicks up a thin layer of cigarette burn and dust. It's no wonder you're confused so much of the time. What? Where's Mom? There was this woman who worked at the factory until not too long ago. He paused, and inside the pause there were memories of Eutiquia, such a small woman who had seen so much of a large world. We got a call today at the plant from the hospital here in San Diego about an employee of the factory who almost died crossing the border last night. They called about her. She must have had our number with her when they found her. So what happened then? Dolores asked, half in the kitchen. No, well, I saw her. She looks bad. They say she snapped her back in two, and her neck is in pieces, all of it. She's broken everywhere and swollen. The nurse told me that they thought she was dead when she arrived, and the doctors didn't even know where parts were. But there she was, all put together with braces and metal rods. Did you know her? Imama? Such a strong woman, and to be so determined. But that's all you really know, determination, because you can never actually guess what it'll be like. But you have this idea, then all you've done is invented it. And it's been invented all along, but it's gotten you far, all the way to the edge of it. Bah? Dolores walked back towards the kitchen table. He placed a hand on the shoulder of the chair across from his father, and it felt heavy on the wood. It's hard to keep at it, hijo. You need to find something that makes your imagination infinite all the time, and that's hard to ask of someone else, no matter how big their eyes are, no matter how honest their breath feels or their giggle sound. He thinks of Eutiquia and the strength she's given him. It has hurt for a long time now, Dolores. It's hurt slowly and each day more. The hurt is like dripping mud that through the years has coated my spine and slowed me, hunched me. It's made me weak in a lot of ways. I've even been weak for you. The image of Yutiko's body braced in rods and rubber veins is still strong in Carlos's head. Bah, what? Elizabeth. Outside is already raining. Through the window in the dining room, Dolores has sat down at the table. There's a lot of rain. It has come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was great. Yeah.